how do we solve the problem of bad code without creating the new problem of a gatekeeper?
Professor Charles Nesson interviews Professor Jonathan Zittrain about generativity and the future of the internet. Recently, the Harvard Law Review published Zittrain's The Generative Internet. In his article, Zittrain points out that the generative capacity for unrelated and unaccredited audiences to build and distribute code and content through the internet to its tens of millions of attached personal computers has ignited growth and innovation in information technology and has facilitated many new creative endeavors. So, what's wrong with that? Well, Zittrain believes that in a generative environment, many security threats thrive, like viruses, and that consumers may respond to them by locking down the net and limiting generativity as we know it. What you'll hear is a conversation moderated by Professor Nesson about what Zittrain believes the future holds, how he sees the battle between privacy and innovation, and what he thinks we can do about it. I'm Amanda Mickle. You're listening to Audio Berkman, produced by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School.
All right, John, so you're into this new way of thinking about privacy.
Yes.
And you've come to it by thinking about generativity.
That's true.
How does the one connect to the next?
Step one was appreciating that even a Windows PC, typically thought of as closed in comparison to a Linux box, is in fact open in the most meaningful sense of the word applied there. And by that I mean that it will run third-party code like Skype, which means that you can transform, you can take on the titans of telecommunications with just, hey, the guys who wrote Kazaa say, hey, we're going to write Skype now, and away they go and they write it, and then everybody in the world can adopt it because of these generative PCs. I think that's amazing. And we run a great risk if we lose those generative PCs and instead move to either information appliances or appliance-sized PCs, where there's a gatekeeper who says what code will run and what won't, that you won't get that kind of good disruption anymore, and that we'll end up having most innovation funneled into websites, and everybody will just have a browser, and that'll be the extent of your ability to create. So I identified generativity as a good thing on a PC, and then I figure, what might stop it? And the answer is generativity, namely the ability for bad code to run on your PC, code that purports to do one thing but does another, code that erases other code, especially in this now newly tightly coupled world where users have incredibly powerful PCs and great bandwidth, and that means they can come down with a virus and hurl it to the next person much more quickly than they could before, means that we better solve the problem of bad code lest consumers cast the deciding vote in what had been a stalemate between, say, those who wish to regulate, like publishers, and those who wish to do anarchic things, like pirates. Consumers could cast the deciding vote in favor of locking stuff down if they experience enough trouble with their open generative platforms because of bad code. So the next step was, we got to solve the bad code problem. How do you solve the bad code problem? Well, most solutions that are obvious today set up new gatekeepers. They have an antivirus platform or the operating system vendor or somebody else telling you top-down, here's what you should run and what you shouldn't. And if you run anything that we say you shouldn't, don't come to us for help later. And especially since many people's use of the PC is in environments where they don't actually control the PC, an internet cafe or a corporate environment, it may mean that those things are locked down from the start and they just won't run new code, even if it's good code. And there have been too many instances in which individuals know better, even than their managers or supervisors in the corporate environment, what's good for the company to set up means of communication with people or with vendors or whoever that aren't approved yet but are still very useful, that would be bad. So how do we solve the problem of bad code without creating the new problem of a gatekeeper? And for that, I turn to the wisdom of the crowds. And I say, there are ways that we could use the very generative features of the internet and the PCs attached to it to have people volunteer their cycles and their bandwidth to give us a much richer and useful snapshot of how code is impacting the network that at this moment no one in the world has. We could have people run a little bit of code on their own machine that monitors the rest of the code and says, essentially, through the power even of just raw statistics, here's what code you have, here's how healthy your machine is on the basis of a few raw demographics, like how many restarts, how many pop-ups, you know, pick your basic equivalent to pulse and breathing rate. And by
what, what's this breathing rate?
I'm saying it's like measuring someone's health using vital signs.
I see.
The ways of gathering vital signs off a computer. And combine it with people's own self-reportage as to how happy they are with their machine right now. And people who are cranky will have a baseline of always being unhappy and will at some point discount their unhappiness. But you can, if n is large enough, statistically say, we can't tell you why, but all we know is that computers that run the following code end up less happy than computers that don't. And that's an incredibly powerful tool. And generatable by the crowds, even without the crowds having in any individual expertise about what makes code good, what makes it bad, what code they even have. I see that as a great generative solution to a generative problem.
Now, wait a second. What it requires is an application local to my machine.
Yes.
That somehow keeps track of all the screw-ups on my machine.
Yes.
Every pop-up, every reset, every crash, every whatever.
Yeah.
It's like a log file.
Yeah.
And it's connected to the net, so it contributes to a grand inventory of log files.
Yes, and while it's at it, it serves as a set of best practices for how such data, which is constantly collected by the operating system, I mean, you've already got these files on your machine, how best that information ought to be collected and sent to the mothership or to a peer without doing something stupid on the boring privacy front that we talked about to begin with. Let this actually be, I mean, the thing that makes spyware bad is not that it involves the movement of data from your machine to somewhere else on the net. If so, every program these days would be spyware. They're all communicating in one way or another. We just don't even know it. Let this kind of software, as an ancillary benefit, show how that data might be collected, the user might be alerted and able to audit it, and it going out in a way that actually doesn't invade your privacy.
And this would be statistical, so...
Oh, well, what I see is that mothership then aggregates the data. It aggregates features of the data, such as where you are in the network, but not so precisely that your identity can be ascertained or triangulated upon. And then, first, there's an open API. So if anybody in the world wants to generatively invent something useful to do with this data, bless them. But in the meantime, we would also undertake to, yes, run some statistical engines, essentially to offer anybody who has volunteered to run this program and have the data collected. It's peer-to-peer, which means it's not just data going out, it's data coming in. They will have the benefit of essentially a dashboard with gauges, and they can select what gauges they want. So it might even just be curiosity. You might say, if you're a nerd, there's basic data about my machine, like how fast it's running. I'm so curious. How does that fall in percentile for all the other machines out there? How fast is my machine? And over the months, you can watch your machine go lower and lower as the rest of the world is upgrading to better machines. Or should I get more memory? How many other machines out there have more memory? I'm about to run Internet Explorer 7. When people go from 6 to 7, do they get happier or do they get sadder? This thing could tell you. And having those gauges there is a fascinating, it's kind of like what Google Trends is right now, released just last week, Google Trends. It tells you from what countries in the world various search terms appear to be popular. It has that kind of, that's cool, curiosity of the sort that I believe got SETI at home so wildly popular as people wanted to contribute some bandwidth and cycles to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
So you're going to build this thing?
Yes.
When's it going to be ready?
When's our interview done?
All right, so I'm up through this badware thing, and I've now got an army of people out there
yes.
who are keeping, protecting,
yes.
allowing me to make protective choices on my machine, which
without
is going to
creating...
prevent this awful thing, and
yes.
somehow that arrives you at this privacy.
Well, right,
issue.
So that there's one more step to take. Because you say, this is great. We've solved the problem, by hypothesis, but we haven't created a new gatekeeper that is susceptible to the mercenary influence that says, wait a minute, while I'm at it, being the high priest who says what's clean and what's unclean, now I'm going to start charging a tax if you'd like me to bless that ham. You know, give me some money. What we see with Goodmail, right? With AOL saying, pay me some money and your spam will become non-spam. Don't pay me some money. I can't tell you whether your mail's going to be spam. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. We update our spam filter all the time. This is this kind of informal extortion under the wonderfully ironic name Goodmail that awaits code, not just data in email, and not just AOL subscribers, but everyone, if we don't solve the problem in a way like this. So this is where I'm still saying this is a great solution. But then I say, okay, if you think constitutionally for a moment, it's like saying the framers are sitting around, right? The one model they had from the king is unitary executive model, right? That has its drawbacks because the king can have mercenary and other influences. So they come up with a bright idea. How about three co-equal branches, right? And you boom, 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 separation of power. I mean, there's something to that. This almost says, well, three, why not 3 million? 3 million co-equal branches, peers, judgments emerge from it, blah, blah, blah. But the problem with it that I see around the corner is that with three branches, especially if they are assigned differing roles from one another, about C.F. Unger, we know where the system experiences a hiccup.
C.F., that means you ignore that site, right?
It means it's an interesting conversation, but not one we should have right now.
I got it. So we'll edit that out.
Okay. Well, for our purposes, Unger's the guy that says the branches aren't so different from one another in function. It's just like whether they have an appetite for the problem. So, like, you would think desegregation is like the executive branch should just make it happen. But, like, the judiciary got an appetite before anybody else did. So desegregation came about through the judiciary. But, you know, it could have been Congress. Congress could have passed a law without the Supreme Court of acting. So it's just kind of like, where do you want to go today? And any branch could basically take up any problem. So, anyway, that's a CF.
I got it.
All right. So here, the branches of government are differentiated, and there's a sequential algorithm among them as to how decisions get made that's often a dual or even tri-key system where the legislature has to pass it, the president actually has to enforce it, and the courts have to not strike it down for the government to be acting, for the giant to be clubbing. And if any part of that machine hiccups, and the whole point of having multiple parts is that you know hiccups are inevitable. Nixon goes nuts, or the court goes off the rails, or, you know, name your problem. Randy Cunningham, the Dukester, gets bribed and, you know, completely abrogates every principle to which he ever subscribed. The other branches stand to correct the ailing one. But it's because you can identify the problem and you have all this due process junk that you learn and extol in law school. This kind of statistical system that I'm talking about, not with three co-equal, clearly algorithmicized branches, but emergent properties of judgment. This is emergent norm, view on something, exactly what gives it the benefit of not being gameable, because basically it wouldn't be clear how to game it. The thing is, the N is so large, you'd have to persuade everybody to, you know, click here to get something going or not to affect the judgment. That also leads to the problem of not being able to know from whence certain judgments arise, and if there are biases, unfairnesses latent within the population, it will be reflected in their judgments, and there's no easy way to gainsay them. And that's what got me thinking about this cafe example, where you have a couple bad experiences with people. Maybe you take a trip to Utah and everybody hates you, and you come out and you've got a reputation now that somehow you haven't been very likable in the past 2 weeks. Then it creates a feedback loop where people treat you more poorly as a result, so you end up getting offended more easily, and then they give you more negative comments. I mean, there's all sorts of dynamics here that are so alien to the normal processes of the rendering of judgments. When you think of the way a court so self-consciously takes in evidence and directs the jury and the judge checks the jury and all that kind of stuff, all of that is out the window. And you just end up with these judgments for which they seem to be right a lot of the time, but it's awfully hard to know when they're wrong or even how to trace ailments in that system.
All right, John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation about generativity and the future of the internet between Professor Charles Nesson and Professor Jonathan Zittrain. I'm Amanda Mickle. You're listening to Audio Berkman, produced by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. On the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu/audio.